Coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
We can find individuals in their 60s and 70s who metabolically look like they're in their 30s. They're physically active, they keep themselves busy. But similarly, we can find individuals in their 30s and 40s who look pretty much like they're in their 60s and 70s. That's a direct reflection of the quality and quantity of their muscle.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark. Like many of you, I'm terrifically busy throughout the week. I'm a doctor, a podcast host, a writer, a speaker, a father. And on top of all those commitments, I have to make time to prioritize my own health along with the health of my patients. Because I have so much on my plate, I value tools that make my life easier. And I'm sure you can relate. And that's why I'm really excited to share with you today a little bit about Rupa Health. When I treat my patients, I look at a lot of indicators such as hormones, organic acids, nutrient levels, inflammatory factors, gut bacteria, all to dig deep down to find the root causes that prevent those patients of mine from optimizing their health and wellness. But that means I'm usually placing orders through multiple labs, which is just an overall pain. Plus, it makes keeping track of results more difficult for me and my patients. But all that changed when I started using Rupa Health. Rupa Health is a place for functional medicine practitioners to access more than 2,000 specialty lab tests from over 20 labs like Dutch, Vibrant America, Genova, Great Plains, and more. Rupa Health helps provide a significantly better experience for both you and your patients. It's 90% faster than ordering tests one by one, and it lets you simplify the process of getting the tests you need. This is great for me because, like most practitioners, I'd rather be spending that time with my patients and not doing administrative work, and that's the great benefit Rupa Health provides. This is a much-needed option in the functional medicine space. It means better service for you and your patients. You can check out a free live demo with a Q&A or create an account at rupahealth.com. That's rupahealth.com. This episode is sponsored by ButcherBox. You probably heard me talk about ButcherBox before because they've revolutionized the process of buying high-quality meat and seafood. I love to cook, and I have a super busy schedule, so whenever I can spend some time in the kitchen, I want to have all my favorite ingredients right at my fingertips. I'm also really picky about the quality of my meat and seafood and can't always find what I want, what I trust, at my local markets. And that is why I love ButcherBox. They make it easy to get humanely raised meat and wild-caught sustainable seafood by delivering it right to my doorstep. There are different box varieties to choose from along with different sizes and an easily customizable schedule for ongoing deliveries. Sometimes I realize I'll be out of town when my next order is due and it's easy to change my delivery date to when I need to. There's nothing quite like a good steak, and ButcherBox 100% grass-fed, grass-finished ribeyes have become a new favorite for me. They're a perfect combination of juicy and tender with a rich flavor, and they're so simple to prepare too. I love searing them with a savory spice blend and serving them with a huge arugula salad for a quick dinner. ButcherBox is committed to humanely raised animals that are never given antibiotics or added hormones, and since they take out the middleman, they're actually surprisingly affordable. The average cost breaks down to about $6 a meal. There is a major stipulation I always tell my patients about when it comes to animal protein. Quality needs to be a priority. And with ButcherBox, you can feel good knowing you're getting the highest quality meat and seafood to optimize your diet. Right now, ButcherBox has a special offer for new members. If you sign up today, you'll get 2 ribeye steaks free in your first box by going to butcherbox.com/pharmacy. That's with an F, F-A-R-M-A-C-Y. That's 200% grass-fed ribeyes by going to butcherbox.com/pharmacy. And now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hi, this is Lauren Feehan, one of the producers of the Doctor's Pharmacy podcast. It might surprise you to learn that muscle is the largest organ in our body. It not only determines our strength, but it is also a key factor in reducing chronic illness, improving health span and longevity, and helping to regulate our metabolism. Essentially, the more muscle we have, the better our body operates. In today's episode, we feature 3 conversations from the Doctor's Pharmacy on why, as a sedentary culture, we need to pay more attention to muscle. Dr. Hyman speaks with Dr. Stuart Phillips and Dr. Chris Rinch on the role of muscle and mitochondria in our health, with Dr. Gabrielle Lyon on why protein is essential to eat to build and maintain muscle, and with Mark Sisson on his approach to building muscle. Let's jump in.
It's not just muscle for locomotion, but it's a metabolic organ. And it's what degrades as we age. And when your muscle function and your muscle mass declines, not only are you more likely to fall and injure yourself and have trouble with just your daily activities of life as you age, but your metabolic health, your hormonal function, your levels of inflammation, your ability to regulate your blood sugar, your testosterone, all are affected by the quality of your muscle. And what happens for most people who are listening and may not realize this, you could be 65 and the same weight that you were when you were 25, but your muscle can be completely different. You can look the same on the outside, but on the inside, your muscle has become marbleized fat, essentially turned into a ribeye from a filet mignon when you were 25. And that has enormous consequences for aging. And every single thing that we think of in terms of aging, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, dementia, in some ways they start in the muscle and the muscle function, because without optimal muscle function, we can't regulate our metabolism and we can't regulate inflammation. We can't regulate our hormones. And that all leads to these abnormal cholesterol levels, abnormal blood sugar levels, abnormal levels of inflammation, low hormone levels that we associate with aging. But often it really starts with the muscle. So it's one of the most neglected and important organs. And it starts to go downhill pretty quick, right? When we're in our 30s and 40s and it gets older. As we get older, we lose strength and muscle mass. But what I think is a little scary is that you know, while you can improve muscle mass at any age, recent studies have shown that it may not actually be able to be fully restored. So why should we focus on prevention, and what can we do to help improve our muscle mass and function, especially in the mitochondria as we age?
Yeah, I think you hit on a key issue about, you know, when muscle mass begins to decline and when the function of our muscles begin to really go sideways. And you know, a lot of people debate when that starts. I think, as your example goes, we can find individuals that we pluck off the street who are in their 60s and 70s who metabolically look like they're in their 30s. And that's pretty much because they're physically active. They keep themselves busy. They probably exercise on a regular basis. But similarly, we can find individuals in their 30s and 40s who look pretty much like they're in their 60s and 70s because they spend a lot of time sitting behind a desk. They don't eat particularly well. They're not that physically active. And really, that's a direct reflection of the quality and maybe to some degree the quantity of their muscle. So I don't know whether your listeners are familiar, but probably if they've heard the term sarcopenia before, that's the age-related loss of muscle mass and muscle function that I think for a long time geriatricians said, you know, that's just a normal part of aging. And one of the things that we like to push is that it's not, and it doesn't have to be, and that really you should try and be as physically active, which is probably one of the key things, have a good diet. And then as Chris's company, as Amazentis, has found out, you can probably do a few sort of nutraceutical tricks, if you like, and prop up that mitochondria inside the muscle, which is another sort of just local indicator of function of that tissue.
Yeah, you know, but it's really key, too, that it's not just the muscle that there's mitochondria in. There's many, many mitochondria in heart and brain tissue and every single cell of your body, because essentially it's the engine that runs every cell. And some cells, like the brain cells, have literally tens of thousands of these mitochondria. Other cells have less, but heart and brain have the most. And that's when they tend to break down as we age. And I think most people don't understand anything about their mitochondria. They understand that they can actually measure its function in different ways that doctors can. Doctors don't know much about mitochondria. We learned this thing in medical school in first year called the Krebs cycle in biochemistry, and we quickly forgot it as soon as we learned it, which is the only time we really paid much attention to mitochondria. And yet it is central to every age-related disease and the aging process itself. In fact, it's one of the most underappreciated aspects of our health, which is why we're having this conversation. I think people need to begin to understand how important their mitochondria is. And a lot of the kind of healthy aging strategies, you know, low sugar diet, more good fats, quality protein, these are all about ultimately helping our mitochondria. And exercise also and strength training are critical for building muscle and helping mitochondria. But the role of mitochondria is pretty interesting in aging. And there's a lot of age-related phenomena that happen that can be reversed by improving the function, the number of the mitochondria. And this is some of the work that's being done, for example, around NAD, which is another healthy aging nutraceutical. But a lot of the intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating,
the low carbohydrate diets, ketogenic diets, these things that have sort of been experimented with all impact the mitochondria and affect their function. And so I think, can you talk about how the mitochondria affects us in terms of the aging process and why it's so important to focus on them?
Yeah, so I think one of the key things, as you said, is that the metabolic processes inside cells require energy nonstop, and it doesn't have to be a muscle cell. Your cardiac cells, your heart is working all the time. Digestive tissue, brain tissue, it's always metabolically active. There's always something going on. So that means that mitochondria are turning out the currency, the energy that we need to be able to function. So no cell really ever, quote unquote, goes to sleep. Even if we go to sleep, the cells are continuously regenerating themselves and renewing themselves. And that's a function of mitochondria. So once those mitochondria begin to function suboptimally, then you begin to see tissues begin to break down, not just muscle, but as you said, brain tissue, cardiac tissue, it could even be adipose tissue. And all of these things really begin to tie together to slow cells down. They don't function as well, and they really can't then talk to each other. So this so-called, what we call organ crosstalk, so between muscle and fat and liver and in parts of our brain, it really begins to break down. And so, as I said, it's a central theory of aging, which is to say that once our mitochondria begin to decline in function, then, you know, things are really going to go poorly. You know, exercise is one way to prop it up, but not everybody can exercise, or not everybody exercises to the degree that they want. And so these adjuncts that we're now seeing, you mentioned NAD, Urolithin A, for example, are all of these, I think, pretty cool compounds that once we just thought, oh, you know, not a big deal, but we're now seeing are pretty important.
Absolutely true. And I think the phenomena around mitochondria that in the research is pretty exciting. And there's all these genes that regulate aging that are in the mitochondria, like FOXO, DAF2, the sirtuins. These are really important regulators, and they're regulated by diet, but they're also regulated by these various compounds, these phytochemicals in plants, which we're going to talk about in a minute, because this is the work that Emazentis is doing. This is the work that they're looking at terms of compounds that come from plant foods that can actually regulate these biological functions in our body. So you can't obviously just take a nutraceutical and eat crappy and not exercise. It's all a package deal, but it really can accelerate the muscle improvement and function. We're going to talk about that. But one of the things that's sort of exciting, and Chris, I want to ask you about this, because we have been hearing a lot about this phenomenon called autophagy, which is this idea that we can clean up and recycle old cells and old proteins and sort of clean up the system to repair, rejuvenate, and extend life and improve health. And that's why people are doing intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating or ketogenic diets, for example. These all improve this phenomenon called autophagy, which literally means eating yourself. But there's another thing that happens in the body called mitophagy, which is an incredible breakthrough in understanding longevity and longevity science, which is understanding this phenomenon of mitophagy. So what is mitophagy, and how does it help to address the phenomenon of aging and improve our overall health and energy production?
Well, Mark, thanks for having me today. Mitophagy is really a way of renewing our mitochondria, particularly when they're damaged. So as you get older and as you're more sedentary, your mitochondria get damaged as they work, as they're producing energy. And what you have inside of each of your cells is a process of renewing your mitochondria. And under this sort of umbrella of autophagy, as you were mentioning, we have mitophagy and sort of the self-eating of mitochondria. So basically it takes care of recycling mitochondria as they get damaged so that the mitochondrial pool is maintained very robust, and you have basically cells with that are more bioenergetically active than they would be otherwise.
That's incredible. You know, one of the things that I find fascinating is this whole idea that I've talked about in some of my books called symbiotic phytoadaptation. and it's a big word I made up myself. and what it means is that we have evolved, and this is just my theory, that we've evolved in conjunction with the plant world and the foods we eat to regulate our biological functions. And that there are 25,000 plus different phytochemicals in plant foods that regulate every single biological function, from our hormones to our immune system to our gut microbiome to our mitochondria to pretty much everything that happens in our body. And we really have only begun to appreciate these recently. In fact, Rockefeller Foundation has funded a study, which they're calling the Periodic Table of Phytochemicals, which is mapping these all out, identifying their function as much as we know, and talking about how do we actually use these in the promotion of health. And so in everything, there's protein that we eat, there's protein, fat, carbohydrate, fiber, vitamins, minerals, et cetera. But there's this other class of compounds that have not been thought to be essential. And I call these the phytochemicals, and that's why I think we actually need these to stay healthy. So they're not necessarily, you're not going to get a deficiency disease, but you might get a chronic disease if you don't have these things. That's my theory anyway. and I'm so excited by the work that Amazentis is doing, because it's really rigorous science that has been published in some of the top medical journals in the world that's looking at some of these compounds in plant foods that can actually regulate key biological functions, especially the mitochondrial function. So there's this compound that you've studied and you basically figured out how to actually extract and make, which is called urolithin A. And just for those who are listening, this is what's so interesting about biology. You eat a pomegranate, which has these elagitannins in it, which is one of these phytochemicals. So you eat a pomegranate, and that chemical interacts with your microbiome. And then if you have a healthy microbiome, it might produce a beneficial chemical called urolithin A. But if you don't, it might not. So what you've done is sort of discovered that this molecule is so powerful in regulating mitochondrial function, and you really done years and years of research to bring it to market. So tell us about urolithin A. How does it work? How does it affect mitochondrial function? And how did you kind of figure this out? Because there's a million plants out there and a million chemicals. So this is sort of like, you know, kind of like a needle in a haystack, right?
Good question, Mark. So it all started for us with the pomegranate. We were looking at the pomegranate and thinking about what type of health benefits it could bring. And we started looking at the compounds inside of the pomegranate. And this led to us understanding more about compounds like elagitannins, which are a big family of compounds that are quite large inside of the pomegranate. And upon studying them, we understood that they were transformed, as you were mentioning before, into urolithin. In fact, into a range of urolithins, which are metabolites, through the gut microflora processing. And it was originally thought that this is just part of the processing and the digestion of the pomegranate, and so wasn't sure, you know, were these urolithins actually doing anything in the body? So we started looking at them, and it was at this point when we were looking at urolithin A that we saw, lo and behold, that it was acting on mitochondria and improving mitochondrial function. And so it's one of these processes where, you know, as you say, a needle in a haystack. But it was through a very systematic dissection, if you will, of the compounds in the pomegranate and following their sort of journey as we consume the pomegranate.
So you were like, oh, let's study the pomegranate and see what's in there. It wasn't like you studied every plant chemical and found out that there was this one that regulated mitochondria.
No. We were really focused on the pomegranate at the time, because there had been some general research on the pomegranate and its health benefits, and so we thought, let's take a deeper dive and try and understand what's there. And I think, as you were saying before, what's really emerged from this is the importance of not only the foods you eat, but importance of the microbiome and how they work together synergistically to create compounds and to extract the health benefits from the food that we eat. And so, you know, it was understanding this and understanding also that very few people can actually perform this conversion. In fact, it's been estimated, and we've done some of our own studies that have shown somewhere between 30 and 40% of the population can actually convert these compounds, these precursor compounds found in the pomegranate, into urolithin A, and that's at even various levels. So what it makes sense is when we studied all this was, well, you know, we don't need to give more pomegranates to people, but we actually need to give urolithin A to people. And if we do it in the right way, if we dose it right, if we deliver it in a very precise manner, we can then get the health benefits that we are targeting and that we've shown that work.
I've been using pomegranate powder and pomegranate concentrate in smoothies for a long time because of the benefits of pomegranate. And it wasn't around particularly the mitochondrial function, it was around the microbiome effects. And so, you know, one of the things we know, for example, is that there's a microbe in the gut called Akkermansia, which is eosinophilia, which essentially creates a coating and a biofilm on the gut that protects it. It regulates the immune system. It's necessary to fight cancer. It's necessary to regulate your metabolism. It's related to autoimmune diseases, and it's very low in many people. And this bug loves pomegranate. And so if you feed a pomegranate, it grows and it can help cure all kinds of issues. What really is fascinating to me is the story of the microbiome and the food we eat. So could you dive a little bit more into how the microbiome interacts with these compounds that we eat, and then what happens to those compounds? How do they then get in our body and interact with everything that's going on? Because I don't think people really understand that. I think it's a very new science, and I think it's really an important thing, because when you're eating plant foods, it's not just for the antioxidants and the benefits that you get from the fiber and the vitamins and minerals. There's this other thing that's going on that has to do with how it interacts with your microbiome. And that is the future. So talk to us about that.
Sure. So as I was mentioning before about the ellagitannins that are found in pomegranates, they're also found in a number of other foods that we eat. We find them in raspberries, and we find them in walnuts and blackberries. And what happens is these compounds are then transformed after you consume them in the stomach. They're hydrolyzed into ellagic acid, and ellagic acid is then transformed by various gut microflora. So the actual identity of the bacteria have not yet been found. But what we see is that there's a range of different metabolites, urolithin A being the most predominant one. And these are then taken up into the body, into the bloodstream, and then they go to the cells. And we found in our first clinical study, we found that we could identify urolithin A actually in the muscle tissue itself.
Wow.
So it actually gets right into the muscle cells. We've shown that, and we've shown through biopsies of the muscle tissue that we impact the mitochondria and the gene expression level of mitochondria in the muscle tissue itself.
That's incredible. So how does it work to cause this phenomenon of mitophagy, this sort of self-cleaning surface, almost like a self-cleaning oven, right? how does it work to induce the self-cleaning process of your mitochondria?
Well, with urolithin A in particular, it's taken into the cells, and what it does is we've shown that it can stimulate this process of mitophagy. It's not known exactly at what point it acts to stimulate the mitophagy, but it increases the clearance of the damaged mitochondria, and consequently we see a renewing of the mitochondrial pool inside of the cells, and so you have a much more bioenergetically favorable environment inside the cells, and the cells consequently function much better.
So what you're basically saying is that when you have this pomegranate compound that it basically should be made by your microbiome, but most of us don't, and you take it as a supplement, that it cleans up the mitochondria and helps to improve the energy production in your cells. Why is that important? Like, why should we care?
Well, I think in particular, as Stuart was mentioning earlier, as you get older, the activity in our muscle, the ability to clear the damaged mitochondria decreases with age. And so This causes a decline in the energy levels inside of our cells and in our muscle tissue. And so then we sort of slow down as we get older, and the muscle stops functioning as optimally, our endurance levels drop. And this is, you know, part of a process in aging where mobility declines. And so, what we're doing by stimulating mitophagy is, to increase that energy level inside of our cells and basically making our muscles function at their bioenergetically optimal state, no matter how much muscle tissue you have. So this is something, it's a really a new approach as opposed to what people have been doing in the past, which has been administering more protein to try and bulk up on muscle tissue. We're all about trying to make our muscle tissue the most functional as possible. As you get older.
So it sort of like accelerates the benefits of exercise, right? So,
yes. And as you were saying before, it's not a substitute for exercise. Basically you want to keep this in your diet as part of your healthy routine, if you will. So you want your exercise, you want to have your right dietary supplements, and you want to eat a very balanced meal. So it's all part of combining the three.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark. As with any time of year, supporting our immune systems is key to optimizing our health. But with fall right around the corner and the season's about to shift, it's super important to keep our immune system in top shape. And that's why today I'm excited to share with you an incredibly easy way to protect your immunity, and that's by incorporating Manuka honey into your daily wellness routine. Manuka is a special type of honey harvested from the forests of New Zealand. It's different from regular honey because it boasts amazing immune and digestive properties, plus antioxidants. Research shows that Manuka honey supports gut health through its prebiotic content and other properties, making a daily spoonful a great part of your regimen. Raw Manuka honey from Comvita stands above the rest. It's really the gold standard in Manuka. Not only is Comvita known across the world for upholding the highest standards of quality and efficacy, but it also tastes better than any other Manuka, in my opinion. Comvita offers the most premium, pure, well-researched, and sustainably sourced Manuka products available on the market today. Comvita can be drizzled over your yogurt, put in a smoothie, in tea, or even just enjoyed by the spoonful as part of a healthy lifestyle. Comvita also offers bee propolis products for your immune support, as well as products for kids. You can learn more at Comvita.com, Comvita.com, where you can enter the code HYMEN25 for 25% off all Manuka honey and bee products. That's Comvita.com. And now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy. Our muscle is our biggest organ in the body.
Yeah.
And it's one of the keys to longevity. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that the silent epidemic out there is this massive loss of muscle in the population. We talk about people being overweight or obese.
Right.
And we think about fat all the time.
Huh?
But we don't think about muscle.
Absolutely.
So why should we think about muscle?
You are starting off with a brilliant point. We talk about being over fat, but really the problem is being under muscled. The concept of muscle-centric medicine is that muscle is the largest organ in the body. And it is not just essential for locomotion, which is typically what we think about, movement and exercise. But in fact, it's our metabolic currency. It is the largest site for glucose disposal. We talk a lot about diabetes, cardiovascular health, Alzheimer's disease. All of these issues of metabolic regulation are largely controlled and contributed by to the amount of muscle that we have. So glucose disposal, lipid oxidation. We hear a lot about cholesterol. Well, if you want to lower your cholesterol and the fatty acids in your blood, you should have more muscle. We also think about cachexia, falls, breaks, injuries.
Cachexia means?
The destruction, the wasting of the body.
Yeah, so you lose muscle and you're skinny, and you could even be thin and have no muscle.
Right. When you think about muscle, it's the reservoir for these amino acids. The more muscle you have, there is less overall mortality. You are stronger. You're able to fend off disease, illness.
Yeah, I just read this study in JAMA recently where guys who can do 10 push-ups or less have a high risk of heart attacks. And if you can do 40 push-ups or more, you're at far, far less risk. And actually, it's protective. And I recently did an aging evaluation and I could do 50 push-ups, which was awesome.
I no was joke. Like, I was like, Mark, why are you so out of breath when you're answering the door? I was like, I'm doing my push-ups, but yeah. Right. So it's clear that muscle is so much more than just this concept of locomotion and movement. It is a metabolic organ. And arguably, it's an endocrine organ. Mm. When you contract your muscle, it secretes things called myokines.
Yeah, wow.
Which are anti-inflammatory.
So it's like the antidote to inflammation, which is the thing that's causing the risk for almost every chronic disease, whether it's Alzheimer's or cancer or diabetes or heart disease, all related to inflammation.
Absolutely. And these concepts relate to body composition. Mm-hmm. There's data to support the wider your waistline, the lower the brain volume. And I did a fellowship
in— So you mean the bigger your belly, the smaller your brain?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. You know, I did a fellowship in geriatrics. And part of that was running a memory clinic. Each fellow's job was to spend 2 years in a memory clinic. And what we said, and then also being out of Sam Klein's lab, we did a lot of research, nutrition, obesity research. And we did studies where we imaged individuals' brains. Mm. And what you see is absolutely the more metabolically dysfunctional they are, the lower the brain volume.
The big belly, small brain.
Exactly.
And that is not a good thing. Now, this whole concept of sarcopenia is something that people don't even know what that is. People know what obesity is, but it's sort of the other side of the coin. It's this loss of muscle. And, you know, I've written a lot about it, and I've talked about strength training and exercise. And the truth is, I really didn't like it because I like to be outside. I like to play. I don't really like to be in a gym. I do, you know, some push-ups and yoga, but
he's going to be weightlifting now.
You've been pushing me. You've been pushing me to do this for a long time, and I finally started working out with a trainer, and it's actually been fun. Yeah. And I'm a little sore, to be honest, but I think I'll get over that. But what happens is, as we age, no matter what weight we are, you could be the same weight at 25 or the 65 and be twice as fat and half as muscle.
Right.
And the same weight. And what turns out is that your hormones, your biology, everything is regulated by your muscle. So you lose muscle, your cortisol levels go up, your stress hormones go up, your growth hormone goes down, your testosterone goes down.
Bad news.
Your insulin goes up, your blood sugar goes up. And yet, this is not something doctors evaluate for, talk about, think about, advise about. Why is that?
Again, because we're focusing on the problem, not the solution. Everybody is focusing on the external issue, which is obesity, likely because you can see it, right? But the solution is muscle. And a lot of physicians are not training themselves. Being a physician, largely, unless you're into functional medicine or really lifestyle, can be very challenging. And oftentimes, the drugs that physicians are prescribing for their patients are often taking themselves.
Yeah.
The concept of muscle and why it's not talked about so much is because I think that we're just very behind on the science and that solution. It requires hard work.
Yeah.
It requires physical work, labor. People don't like to do that.
Yeah. It's easier to take a walk than to pump iron.
Right? That is activity. That is not working out.
Yeah.
There's a certain amount of stress and being regimented. You're working with a trainer, having a well-designed program to really begin to work the muscle. And as we age, we get something called anabolic resistance. And
what does that mean?
The muscle has a difficult time utilizing protein. Mm. There are all these things working.
So that you could eat a steak, but it doesn't actually turn into muscle.
Well, you can eat a steak, but the amount that you would have to eat as someone who is above 40 versus 20 is different. Mm. Because when you're young, you have, like you said, growth hormone, testosterone, all these hormones running through your blood. As we age, really typically beginning around 40, is those levels begin to decline. Mm. Those levels all affect muscle. As those hormonal levels and growth hormone levels decline, we get this kind of resistance. It's not an inability, but it requires more protein, more amino acids to begin to stimulate that tissue. Mm. So aging well is very targeted.
Uh-huh.
So let's just back up a little bit for people. What is protein anyway? Like, we know fat, we know carbohydrates.
Protein is the black sheep of the macronutrient family.
Yeah.
That is all neglected, we need to
right?
know, right?
Everybody's talking about carbs and fat. Who's talking about protein?
Protein. We've been talking about it for years. It is absolutely the black sheep. It is very emotional for people because it has a face. Mm. Nobody argues that sugar, excess sugar, excess carbohydrates are bad. We thought that fat was bad, and now we kind of have a new understanding. And people are still kind of weighing in on protein. Mm. It is very much the black sheep. You ask me what it is. It is essential for the building blocks of everything. Skin, neurotransmitters, hormones. It is ultimately what life is made of. It is the baseline fundamentals. And not only that, it
is— And by the way, all your genes do, you have 20,000 genes, all they do is make protein.
Right.
And they make protein out of the building blocks of protein that you eat.
Correct. And dietary protein is key to getting all of those amino acids. And anyone, you can open up a textbook and look at all the amino acids. They all have different things. I will point out that if you look at the label of any nutritional supplement, it will have a breakdown of carbohydrates, how much fiber, how much sugar, fat. It will have a breakdown of saturated fat, all the other fats. And then you get to protein. And it just has one little line, protein. But not all protein is created equal. You have animal protein and you have plant protein, all of which are made up of different amounts of amino acids, which affect your body differently.
Okay, well, you just brought this up, so we're going to go there. I was going to get into a little bit later, but the issue is what kind of protein and how much protein? Because one, there is an argument that we are eating too much meat in the world, that it's causing climate change, that it's destroying natural habitats, destroying soils, depleting our water supplies.
We should talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it.
Okay, good.
And that we should all be eating more plant protein and more rice and beans.
We tried that. And you know what that was called?
Mm-mm.
The food guide pyramid.
Yeah. Well, we eat a lot of carbohydrates, but I don't know if we weren't eating rice and beans. We were eating bread and potatoes and chips and, I mean, sugar. And
okay, right. But even if you swap it out and the carbohydrate load is in excess, right? So when we look at what we really need, we probably need between 70 and 80 grams of carbohydrates, and the body can make all of that from protein.
Yeah, right.
So
let's just get back to this. So we do need protein. And also the studies were interesting. Even the studies that show that maybe excess protein when you're younger makes you sick. It turns out even those studies show that when you're older, you actually need more protein.
You do.
And I just was reading about athletes eating maybe between 1.6 to 2.4
Absolutely.
Grams of protein, which is a lot of protein
Yep.
per kilo.
Yep.
And so we're getting all these mixed messages. You know, one, we should be eating less meat, eating more plant proteins, or two, we should be eating more protein as we age. So we're in this sort of incredible, conflicted, confusing environment around protein. So what should we be eating? How much should we be eating? And what type should we be eating?
Okay. This is a no tall order that we need to discuss.
You know, this is a big, this is what people want to know.
Let's take one step back. The information overload comes from kind of the mouse with the microphone. So you have small groups of individuals that are making a lot of noise. So
you mean the computer mouse?
You have extreme groups. So you have anti-animal groups, you have PETA, you have vegan groups, vegetarian groups that are just in one aspect making a lot of claims, putting a lot of money, I think. PETA spent $15 million on advertising. Then you have big cereal companies, Kellogg's. I think that was around $1 billion in advertising. So you have these groups that are regulated by the FTC. And then on the other side, you have the Egg Council and the cattlemen and the farmers or who are under the guise of the USDA.
Yeah.
So you have these two kind of regulating bodies and two opposing groups. One which has much more money than, say, the Dairy Council or the Egg Council, that in and of itself skews the conversation.
Mm.
And that is something really important to be aware of.
So we're getting a lot of propaganda, but not a lot of science, is what you're saying.
We have big pharma. We have these groups that are allowed to say certain things, that maybe this will lower cholesterol, eat oats, it will lower cholesterol. It will have these certain health benefits. And then you've got egg, dairy, beef, who are not allowed to make any similar claims. We do have a lot of propaganda and bad science that is very agenda-driven.
Yeah.
And that creates an environment of confusion.
Yeah, like the Lancet Commission, which was like, we should eat like 3 ounces of meat a week, maybe, or,
So we know. So let's talk about the RDA. So the current RDA, which is—
It's the recommended dietary allowance.
Correct. Right. And that was based on studies that we know were flawed, right? Those were based on nitrogen-based studies of 18-year-olds that we wanted to, or the they wanted to provide an amount which would stop disease, it's baseline for disease. It's the minimum amount
you need so you don't get sick. It's not how much you need to be healthy.
Correct. So we came up, or they came up with a number, not me, way before my time, unless my Botox is that good, but not having any lately. The RDA is 0.8 grams per kilogram, and that spans from anyone ages 18 and beyond. 18, 50, 60, 80. Okay. That is the minimum amount. There is 30 years of data to support that the minimum amount is not adequate. We know that as you age, you need double the RDA. For body composition, you're looking at double the RDA.
You mean for building more muscle?
For anything. In obesity, we know that the higher your diet is in protein while calories are controlled, the more lean muscle mass you can maintain. And we spoke, when we started talking about this, we talked about why muscle was so important. And this obesity epidemic isn't quite an obesity epidemic. It is really an epidemic of poor muscle mass, low muscle mass, obesogenic sarcopenia, loss and destruction of tissue. We are largely domesticated. So what's happened is we have—
Wait, what do you mean we're largely domesticated?
We ride in cars. Oh. We're not doing physical movement. We are eating in a way that is not supporting our current existence. And actually, red meat consumption has gone down by 29% since 1975.
But chicken's gone up.
Chicken has gone up. Dairy has gone down.
Yeah.
The concept that we are eating too much protein, the average American eats between 60 and 90 grams. Women are around maybe a little bit above 60 grams, and men are around 90 grams. So that's the average American. Heart disease, Alzheimer's, obesity, hypertension, all of these comorbidities and diseases are on the rise.
Yeah.
Protein is not the problem. Protein's never been the problem. Mm. Protein is the defining nutrient for a high quality diet.
As you get older, the importance of lean tissue becomes more and more critical.
Yeah, muscle is the forgotten organ.
It's the forgotten, and people think, well, if I'm jogging in my 50s and 60s and 70s, or riding a bike, that's accomplishing what I need to accomplish, and it's not. It's much more important to spend some time in the gym lifting heavy weights, like the heaviest weights you can lift without getting hurt.
Yeah,
without getting hurt is a key component. I don't want to.
So my trainer tells me I should do like more reps, like I do 3 sets.
Yeah.
And I do, it's pretty hard, but it's not like my maximum that I can do. Sometimes it is. But is that the same, or is it more better to do heavy weights?
How many reps do you do? Are we talking like 6 or 35?
10 to 12, and then I do 3 times.
That's fine. That's a standard. That hasn't changed in decades. That's still, and there's no right answer there. There's no magic. It's like whatever you feel good doing.
Is that building enough muscle, or should I do more heavier weights?
Sure. Fewer reps. Heavier weights and fewer reps builds more strength over time. But there's no, I can't tell you that's where you need to go. But I'll give you an example. It's sometimes the type of weights you're doing. So if you're just doing bicep curls, that's, for the beach, but that doesn't really impact bone density, muscle mass throughout. So hex bar deadlifts, you ever do those?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the best thing you can do.
What about just a regular deadlift?
Yeah, they're good, but I'm too concerned with my back.
So I
lift heavy with a hex bar deadlift.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, but I do it once every week, and I do 3 sets of that. I keep adding weights until
How much do you do?
I do up to 300 pounds. I do one, to 2 rep max on 300.
Oh, 1 to 2 reps.
Yeah, I can do 335 on one, but it's too much. I wind up taken too long to do it, and I'm afraid I don't want to hurt myself.
Yeah.
So I do, but that's like that one exercise impacts the entire body.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just what you would see obviously from doing the weight of, you know, the glutes and the lower back and the hamstrings and the quads, but you know, it's pulling on the shoulder muscles. Like my grip strength is sometimes the thing that gives out more than anything else. But that one exercise then has an effect on the pulse of growth hormone and testosterone through a, you know, it involves so many muscles, and including major muscles, that then when you go do the pull-ups and the push-ups and the dips and the squats and all the other the lunges, then you get the impact is greater. The effect, the muscle-building effect is greater because you did that.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. So I should do that first.
Or last or whatever.
All right. But well, that's amazing.
If you do it first, a lot of times you'll you won't have the strength to complete the other stuff.
So what is the biology of doing it? You mentioned you can burn fat, but why is that better? Like what does it do in terms of longevity? What does the science show?
Well, as burning sugar is in and of itself, it produces reactive oxygen species at a greater rate than putting combusting fat through the mitochondria. Mm-hmm. So the more energy you can derive through this metabolic pathway that uses the mitochondria, the better off you are. A lot of times people burn sugar in the cytosol of the cell, not even...
The way I think about it is interesting. So when you eat a lot of sugar calories and starchy calories, it burns dirty in your mitochondria and it releases a lot of waste products, which is these reactive
oxygen species
or oxidative stress or free radicals that are driving aging.
Yeah.
And when you burn ketones, more like hybrid, electric vehicle, it burns clean, right?
Like a 93 octane on your fuel.
Yeah, it burns much cleaner.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That's true. I mean, that's the simplest way of looking at it. Then there are other nuances to this, which are when you become good at burning fat, then when you skip a meal or when you have this very easy to manage compressed eating window, all the good stuff happens when you're not eating.
Yeah.
So when the longer you can go, and that's why fasting has become the rage, the longer you can go without eating, the more your body says, oh, this is a great time to do some house cleaning.
Yeah.
And, you know, the term autophagy is thrown out probably too much now. But you know, the body does tend to want to clean up and consume damaged proteins.
So autophagy means like you're literally eating yourself.
Correct.
So eating all the waste products.
Eating the waste products.
Pac-Man goes around and cleans
correct.
Up the
and if you place. And if you never... fast, you just become this increased collection of garbage in your body.
So the whole three meals, three snacks, eat late at night after dinner snack, and wake up eating right away. That's a bad idea.
It's a bad idea. And what's ironic to me is that even going back 15 years ago in the bodybuilding and the weightlifting and the general health community, the mantra was don't go more than 2 hours without eating. You bring your Tupperware, you know, little meals with you with, you know, some amount of protein, some amount of carbs, and no fat, skinless chicken breast, and, you know, all that stuff. It was a horrible concept, and yet the thought process was, you know, you don't want to cannibalize your muscle tissue, and if you go more than 3 hours without eating, you'll cannibalize your muscle tissue. Now, all of that was predicated on an assumption that glucose was the primary fuel that we needed.
Yeah.
When we ran out of glucose, it would cause the brain to go into a state of, oh my God, send a signal to
the
adrenals to secrete cortisol so we can basically melt some muscle tissue and send some amino acids to the liver to become glucose.
Exactly.
It was a horrible, it was all based on the wrong, on a concept that somehow assumed that glucose was the muscle fuel that we needed, and if we didn't manage glucose, all hell broke loose. So now we know that fat is the preferred fuel for human movement and human activity, and that ketones are not just a legitimate alternative energy source, they're probably a preferred energy source in many cases.
Now, as a doctor, I see a lot of patients, and I test them, and I see the results. And it's humbling because you can come up with all these great theories, but then you see the individual in front of you. And I've had patients I put on a ketogenic diet eating butter and coconut oil all day, and they lose 20, 30 pounds. Their cholesterol comes down 100 points. Their triglycerides drop. Their good cholesterol goes up. Somebody else does that, and all their numbers go terrible. Mm-hmm. And they start getting really bad cholesterol numbers. And I'm one of those guys. If I eat too much of saturated fat, I get in trouble. Yep. And I think, how do you understand sort of how to personalize this? So,
all right. So a couple things. First of all, you know, we've never had this conversation, so I don't know what your stance is currently on this. But, you know, I've been pushing for 15 years to take the weight off cholesterol as a bad guy. You know, the cholesterol is not the proximate
cause. In the blood or in the diet?
Both. But let's just talk blood cholesterol right now. I don't think cholesterol is a bad guy. Cholesterol is one of the most important
molecules
in the human body. It's integral to life. The body makes 1,300 milligrams a day, whether or not you have any in your diet. And to vilify it and spend $1 trillion for the last 15 years to try and eradicate it in humans is absolutely unconscionable.
Through statin medications.
So, and I shared with you before the show. So I just had some blood work done. I'm between 245 and 290 on my total cholesterol. But my HDL is 98.
That's the good cholesterol.
You know, and my triglycerides are always below 75, sometimes 45 or 50. My A1C is 4.9, which you know to be...
That's your average blood sugar, which is really low.
Really low. Fasting insulin is, you know, between 6 and 7. It can be as high as 45 in some people. So all my markers are great, except that if you didn't ascribe to that whole cholesterol theory, you'd go, oh my God, Mark, we got to put you on a... Everything looks great. By the way, I had a full scan of my carotids and all my blood supply to my coronary arteries, my liver. I mean, they were digging in so deep. I thought, oh my God, they're looking to see if I have colon cancer. But they were trying to get at my kidney supply. And they said, like, you're clean. You got like the blood supply of a 30-year-old. It's clean as can be. Mm-hmm. That's all that counts, Mark. I don't care what my cholesterol numbers are.
But aren't some people more at risk though?
Some are. Some with but again,
is lean mass hyper-responder phenomena.
Yes, and it all I think comes down to. And I'm not a doctor, so you know I'm only giving you my opinion. You can opine with greater, I guess you have more. More liability for saying it than I do. I have no liability as long as I say I'm not a doctor. But it's inflammation and oxidation that are the primary culprits here. And so if you have an otherwise inflammatory lifestyle, inflammatory diet, we can talk about sugar, we can talk about stress, we can talk about, and then we can talk about some familial predisposition.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But in general, so back to your two people, some succeed wildly on the ketogenic diet, and some not so much. But the not so much, if you're evaluating just on short-term blood markers, I'm not going to say it's not working. I'm just going to say if you're keto and you're good at burning fat, you got to transport the fat somehow to the muscle cells. You've got there are a lot of things going on here.
Yeah, we just don't know.
And we just don't know. Mm. Now, some people, having said all of that, some women in particular are not good responders to keto. It may be
who shouldn't be on it.
So I think pregnant women probably you just work with some, if you want to do this and you insist on doing this, work with somebody who knows what they're doing, right? And I wouldn't introduce a 3-year-old kid to a ketogenic diet.
Right.
You know,
do you think it's something everybody should be on, or?
I think at some point in their lives, everybody should be on it because it's the human experience.
So you think cyclical keto, this
cyclical
idea.
Cyclical keto, yeah.
So do you ever go above the 50 grams of carbs?
Oh my God. I have, last night I'm visiting here in Los Angeles. My daughter is a great chef and she made a lasagna last night. Like, I'm not going to not eat 2 servings of that. I mean, you know, and it was somebody's birthday and we had some pie. And, you know, yeah. I didn't sleep as well as I would have had I not done that. But I also, like, it's totally comfortable in
so
the
then
fact
you go
that,
in and out.
In and out. And that's
what we historically did.
That's exactly. So when we talk about, you know, we're humans, you know, always keto. No, there were periods of time when there was no access to food. You were like automatically, you were obligatory keto when you didn't eat.
Yeah.
But because you didn't eat processed crap and industrial seed oils that would infect your insulin sensitivity and all these other things, even if you came across a treasure trove of bee honey or it was late in the season and you had a bunch of fruit, you know, you'd store it as fat, but then you'd go right back to being keto when the food supply was cut off.
Yeah.
And you didn't go, you know, as some of these people do, well, you know, whenever I have more than 60 grams or 70 grams of carbs, I get kicked out of keto. Kicked out of keto means nothing to me. Like, I don't even care what your keto numbers are.
So you don't think about measuring it or... tracking
it? I think it's a parlor trick. So what'll happen is people who are new to keto will go, they'll chase the numbers, right? So they'll say, well, I didn't eat, you know, any carbs today, and I just had MCT oil, and I had my, you know, bulletproof coffee and whatever, and I'm showing 4.5 millimolar or 6 millimolar.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, baby, I'm keto. Well, you're keto, you're producing ketones, but one of the things you got to look for is you're just pissing those out. So your body's has not become good at using them yet. You'll get there, but right now your liver's going crazy trying to make ketones, and you don't know how to burn them. So once you build the metabolic machinery to burn ketones, and once you build the facility,
and it doesn't go away when you have a pie and lasagna.
No, exactly. So let's talk about that. But once you built that, you spent 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you know, building that metabolic machinery. You've reset your metabolism to one of metabolic flexibility and metabolic efficiency. Then, if you go off the wagon, you know, one meal or eat one day of 300 grams of carbs, you might feel bad, but you just come right back to where you were. It doesn't shift all the way back to being a sugar burner. Now, if you did it for three more weeks of just doing sugar, the body would say, well, I guess we don't need this expensive machinery lying around burning fat all the time now. Yeah. I guess we're going to just go back to burning sugar, so we'll let all of these things atrophy.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. One of the best ways you can support this podcast is by leaving us a rating and review below. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.